From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Later on the program today, hear from a group of anti-violence advocates who are working to take back the night. But first, the amount of Wisconsin land being farmed is on the decline. For the first time in 4 years, there were fewer farmed acres in 2021 than in previous years. But what is behind that trend, and how will it affect farmers in southwestern Wisconsin? Joining us are several guests today. First of all, Greg Bussler is the state statistician in the Wisconsin Field Office for the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. Greg, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you for having me, Ezra. I appreciate being here.
Also joining us today is Dave Daniels. He's the vice president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Dave, thanks a lot for being here.
I appreciate the time to talk about this subject.
And joining us, hopefully momentarily, will be Darren Von Ruden, who's the vice president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, and we'll welcome him into the conversation when he's able to join us. Dave Daniels from the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, looking at the number of farms total in Wisconsin and the farms that you represent in western Wisconsin, does this somewhat downward trend over a year, do you find that troubling in any way?
Well, I'm from the southeast part of the state right now, Ezra, but you know, we represent all farmers all over the state, and I think the downward trend is very minimal comparison to the large scale. One of the things that we see is, you know, there's some farmer retirements that are coming about, and one of the things, especially in my area, is there's some solar projects that are taking up some land space, and that could be a reason for farms to look at maybe exiting out of the farming industry and still keeping their land, but renting it out to a solar project and having that for retirement, which is what farmers usually do. Is they have that land base is kind of their 401k. So that's something that they use for their retirement, whether it goes to a sibling of theirs or maybe to a neighbor or to some other thing that is going on in their neighborhood.
Darren Von Ruden is with us, and he is the president, the vice president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, when you hear from your farmers, what are their concerns in terms of how the economy is working for them? The report that we referenced a while ago suggests that there's slightly fewer acres being dedicated to farming, slightly fewer farms actually in business. But what does that translate to in terms of the economic realities that farmers who are still in the business are facing?
Well, you know, it's a scenario that we really don't want to see at all. You know, we'd much rather see more farms and more land going into production. But as you can see, continue to see urban sprawl, and then as Dave mentioned too, there's solar projects and wind farms going up around the state too. So there's going to be actually less productive acres for crops. But it's the farmers' new way of making income off of their farms too by you know, working with these solar companies and wind farms. But, you know, we are in a, you know, another different time and a struggling time because of what's going on, you know, really around the world, certainly with the crisis in Ukraine right now. Farmers are going to be paying 2, 3, maybe even 4 times as much for fertilizer this year compared to what we did, unless they locked in early, like some farmers try to do on a yearly basis. But economically, you know, it's going to be a real struggle again. Prices are up, but our expenses are also up 2 to 3 times or more in some instances.
Dave, when you're looking at your membership or maybe in your own experience, these fluctuating prices can be a really big deal in the cost of what it costs to produce whatever it is that a farmer is producing. And yet, when the public goes to the grocery store and they see prices that are going up a little bit or maybe down a little bit, or something's on sale this month or it costs extra this month, that's not always something that they think about. They're thinking about their own pocketbooks when they're thinking of of, you know, how much apples or green beans or potatoes or whatever costs, and they're not necessarily thinking of how much it costs that farmer to get fertilizer or seed or to whatever else that they need to grow that product. What do you hope the public can recognize about the costs associated with farming?
And that's kind of the biggest challenge that we have in production agriculture, is telling the story of how we produce our products, whether it's dairy, corn, or soybeans, or beef, and what it takes to produce that animal to go to harvest. And that is what we need to do, and we're trying to do that on a statewide level, is try to facilitate that. One of the other things is that, you know, we see more local markets going in place, and the consumers would like to have more say, or not more say, but more knowledge of where their foods come from. And that is always a plus, but we, you know, as producers, we try to make sure that we can facilitate to them the challenges that we have, not only in the input side, but also in the, what we look at is, you know, people looking for land to maybe build a house on in the urban sprawl that we talked about here. But then also in the last couple of years with the virtualness of people being able to work, not going to a workplace, that's allowed them to look at different options for them.
Greg, looking at the farms that exist throughout our state and across our, in particular, our southwestern Wisconsin region, if data are available for that, I'm wondering about, like, how farms, when you talk to farmers or when you look at it at the USDA, how are those farms, like, classified? How many of the really big farms are there? How many of them are more of your traditional family farm type operations? How do you classify those kinds of things, and how should the public think about that?
Basically, the definition of farm is set by Congress, and currently it's at $1,000 a year or more of sales. So, what's kind of unique about Wisconsin is the variety of farms and the diversity of farms that are out there versus some other states. You know, Wisconsin's dairy, corn, soy production, hogs, cattle, vegetables, and the whole gamut. So there's quite a variety there. And a statistic from the 2017 Census of Agriculture is that 96% of Wisconsin farms consider themselves a family farm. So we basically let farmers self-report the type of operation that there are. So, but family farms can include everything, smaller operation up to a large operation with $1 million or more of sales.
I don't know who wants to tackle this one first, but when we talk about fewer farms, we're talking about the number of farms, but also the number of acres that are farmed. Is there a target that is desirable, or a benchmark that your various organizations represented here want to see the industry hit from year to year in Wisconsin? Let's start with Greg on that one. Is the USDA looking for a particular number of farmed acres or of actual farms?
We try and capture data on all types of farms and so on. And as I said previously, farm is defined as $1,000 a year or more of sales. So We don't necessarily, you know, specific levels or whatever. That's more for the policymakers and people like that to address, as far as legislation in the farm bill. What, you know, our agency tries to do is make the data that are available, collect the data from farmers, and let them use, let the policymakers and different organizations like Farmers Union and Farm Bureau decide what policy should be that best helps, you know, a majority of farmers.
Darren, from your perspective with the Wisconsin Farmers Union, and Dave, I'm interested in hearing from you as well. But starting with Darren, when you talk about concerns that farmers have, looking at what it takes to make their farms work, looking at whether that farm might be able to be, you know, passed on to the next generation and continue that family tradition or not. What are the concerns that weigh on your membership in terms of the future of farming in Wisconsin?
Well, it certainly is the amount of income that can be generated on that farm. And so, you know, there's different thresholds for pretty much every family. You know, some families want to see a lot more income come in, and others are happy with minimal income and then having off-farm jobs to supplement that. But, you know, certainly we need to look at something that can generate an income for, you know, the majority of farms. And over the, you know, past decade and even the past couple of decades, we've seen a lot more farms going out of business because the economics just are not there. And, you know, and looking at the last question that you asked too, you know, we need to see more farms to diversify our production system, which means that we really should see more land. But then, you know, as I mentioned earlier too, with urban sprawl, we're always running that issue of how do we make our land as productive as possible. And, you know, today's genetics, both in animal agriculture and crop agriculture, have allowed us to be more productive on less land. You know, the biggest question is probably what is that benchmark that we will not be able to produce enough food for our own nation's need. And, you know, with genetics, we're hoping that we can continue to stay ahead of that with, even with the loss of lands and loss of farmers, we're more productive today than we've ever been, and it'll probably continue that way. But just looking at that diversity question, you know, how do we make sure that we have a diverse style of agriculture, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country?
Dave, Darren is mentioning diversity in the style of agriculture. He's talking about concerns about how to make a living into the next generation. When you look at the future of farming in Wisconsin, what concerns do you see either yourself or among your membership?
Well, as Darren said, we have a great diversity of different types of farms within Wisconsin. We try to be a general farm organization and try and help those farms out, no matter if they're a cranberry grower or a beef grower or a dairy farmer. And so, you know, we have to look at some of the regulations that are there. We have to also look at, you know, the aging population of the farmer has always increased. It's never really decreased in the last 20 years. So to bring on those younger generation, I think we need to look at different policies that help them continue on, because as farmers grow, the amount of equity that they own is very large. And that's the thing that is most perplexing, is trying to make enough income to make sure you can buy, or not buy out, but you know, let your parents have a good retirement, and you also have a good living on the farm. So those are the challenges that are out there. And as you can see, you know, when we looked at the one of the articles talked about the category of sales was over $500,000 of sales. Well, that's really a 100 cow dairy, which is below average for the state of Wisconsin. So there's quite a few farms that are, you know, looking to expand, and maybe it's that younger generation that wants to have a little more land to work with and everything else.
When you're compiling this data for the USDA and you're looking at the number of farmed acres now in Wisconsin versus years past, what is that trend? What is that trend looking like in terms of maybe now compared to 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Sure. Basically, there's Wisconsin farms are compared to 2017 down about 1%, and compared to 2012 down about 8%. And this decrease is kind of similar to the national trend as far as number of farms have decreased over the past 5 years. And nationally, the number of farms has decreased about over the last 10 years, about 5%. So there's been a little bit higher decline in Wisconsin over the past 10 years than the national average.
Is that, I mean, I know part of your job, most of your job in compiling this report is to collect the data. Is it fair of me to ask you to interpret it a little bit and ask whether that decline concerns you?
I guess what you have to look at, it may not, you know, even though the numbers show a decline and so on there, you kind of have to look at the individual data and so on. Biggest decline from last year to this year was in the less than $10,000 category. So it was between $1,000 to $10,000 showed at least about 500 farms. But all our other categories either remain the same or were slightly higher. So, you know, part of that could be attributed to farmers making more and getting bumped up to a higher category because over the past year we've had stronger prices for both milk and also commodity.
That's Greg Bussler. He's a state statistician for the Wisconsin Field Office of the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. Darren Von Ruden is with us as well, Vice President of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. And Dave Daniels is the Vice President of Wisconsin Farm Bureau. I'm grateful for their participation on today's program. We are talking about farming here on Wisconsin Public Radio today on Newsmakers. We always want to hear from you, too. Are you a farmer? How have changes in the economy affected your family? What agricultural issues do you want Newsmakers to talk about on future shows? You can email us at newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Back in just a moment, this is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Wisconsin Bureau. We're talking about the state of farming in Wisconsin today on Newsmakers. Joining us are Greg Bussler with the USDA, Darren Von Ruden from Wisconsin Farmers Union, and Dave Daniels from Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. I want to circle back and find out a little bit about each of your organizations, membership, the people that you represent as well. Starting with Dave, let's talk about the Farm Bureau Federation. What is your role with representing farmers in Wisconsin, and how many farmers do you represent?
Well, we have a membership of about a little over 45,000 members, and that is not necessarily all farms, but there is some substantial majority of them are farmers. So we were a general farm organization. We look to try and keep policy that's beneficial to the farming and agriculture. So that's something that we continue to strive for, not only in Madison, but also with our counterpart at the national level, which is American Farm Bureau.
Darren, what about you, the Wisconsin Farmers Union? Tell me about your group.
Yes, so we're a general farm organization too, having farmers in many different styles of agriculture. We have a little over 2,000 family farm members, and the majority of them are family farmers. We also have a core group of members that are growing that are CSA farmers, the community supported agricultural farmers. So fruits and vegetables, some actually do small beef packs and pork packs for their CSA members. And so, you know, we're an organization that wants to make sure that we become more diversified and also want to make sure that the economic stability of every farmer is good in the state.
I know that Greg Bussler, I know that you're involved in the statistical analysis of farms here in Wisconsin, but more broadly, what does the USDA do to work with individual farmers in the state?
I represent the National Agricultural Statistics Service, which is an agency within USDA. We're basically the fact finders for agriculture. We collect data and disseminate it. We're kind of a non-political organization. You know, we put the data out there for anyone to use, that type of thing. So we basically collect it from farmers and put it out there that other agencies can use within USDA and government. A lot of data that we collect, especially on the Census of Agriculture, gets used in the Farm Bill. There's other agencies within USDA, like Farm Service Agency, that takes care of the farm program as far as implementing paying farmers.
I know that Greg's organization, Greg's a part of the Farm Bureau, the National Agricultural Statistics Service. As he mentioned, is not partisan, and I want to definitely leave you out of any sort of conversation about that. But I'm going to ask Darren and Dave. Let's start this time with you, Dave. From a policy perspective, what are things you think that could help Wisconsin's farmers have a higher degree of success?
So one of the things that has passed at the state legislature is producer and farmer watershed groups. And getting dollars to help them look at different ways of protecting water and water quality around the state. So we hoped that was going to pass, and it did pass. That's one of the policies that we wanted to come and see that the farmers are doing the right jobs and on the agricultural land. We've got Discovery Farms that works with the State Department, DADCAP, that looks at different ways of controlling how fertilizer is put on the ground and making sure that we don't overuse it, because we don't want to overuse it because it costs way too much. So that's some of the things that we're trying to make sure that happens, so the economics of farming can continue to keep families on the farm.
Darren Von Ruden from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. What about you? Policy help from our state legislators or others that might put Wisconsin farmers on a better track, or maybe keep them on the right track?
Well, certainly looking at market consolidation is a big issue that we've had for 2 years now within the state level here, and trying to make it so that we've got more places to buy the products we need, and more places to sell the products that we have to sell. And, you know, it's really a national issue that we are trying to address. When you look at the meatpacking industry, for instance, 80% of the beef is processed by four individual processors. And so looking at those numbers, we really would like to see more of those. And, you know, here within the state, the Department of Agriculture has got a couple different programs going right now, trying to increase the number of slaughtering facilities or harvest facilities, and also trying to make sure that we have folks to actually run those facilities and also manage them. UW-Madison has got a good meats program now. There should be more participants, but you know, that'll come too as the knowledge of the industry starts to turn around. And we really need to see, you know, more of that local farmer to consumer connection, and I think both farmers and consumers want to see that, versus depending on our food source coming from another state or even sometimes another country.
Speaking of those consumers, Darren, I know that a lot, well, all of our audience, farmers included, consume the products that farmers provide for us. But for those people who are listening to this conversation and they're not themselves farmers, but they want to know how they can support Wisconsin farmers, what's the biggest thing that a member of the public can do in terms of supporting Wisconsin agriculture?
Well, certainly buy local. That's the big thing. If you can get the majority of your food source from a local store or even going directly to the farms, that certainly is the best, because you're cutting out all those transportation costs that have continued to raise the price of food throughout the country and for many decades now. And we're seeing more and more farmers markets popping up around the state of Wisconsin, but really around the country too. We're even starting to hear about some farmers markets that are popping up in North and South Dakota, which most of the time we think those are just commodity states, but the consumer in those states too is looking for that local food source. So buy local and try to buy as much as you can to support your family at that local area.
Dave Daniels with the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. What about those consumers that are looking to support your members?
Sure. And I'm going to give a dairy plug here, because I am a dairy farmer, but 90% of the milk, or over 90% of the milk, is made into cheese in Wisconsin. And if you look on a cheese package and it says something special from Wisconsin, that's made and produced by Wisconsin dairy farmers and cheesemakers. So I'm going to give a plug for that in the grocery store. But then again, as Darren says, there's more and more CSAs, more and more local things set up for purchasing locally and from the local farmers. So if they can do that, it would be an advantage to that local economy.
Greg Bussler from the USDA, I'm interested to know what are you working on right now in terms of data about Wisconsin farming that our audience should keep their eyes out for?
Sure. Right now, our agency is conducting the 2022 Census of Agriculture. Right now, we're now trying to make sure we got all the list of farmers that we're updating our names of farmers and in the Wisconsin nationally. And in November of this year, we're now out the census of agriculture to every known farm in the country and in Wisconsin. And it's the most comprehensive data set that we do, and basically gives us a snapshot of agriculture in the state and nationally. We ask everything from the producer to their income and expense and demographic information of farms.
Greg Bussler is with the USDA. He's the state statistician for the Wisconsin Field Office, the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Greg, thank you very much for being on Newsmakers today.
Thank you for having me, Ezra.
Darren Von Ruden is the vice president of the Wisconsin Farm. Darren Von Ruden is the vice president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Ezra.
And Dave Daniels is the vice president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Dave, thanks for being on Newsmakers.
Appreciate the opportunity to be on Newsmakers, Ezra.
I appreciate all of you very much. Coming up next, hear from a group of anti-violence advocates who are working to take back the night. And remember, you can hear this conversation again or stream any of our previous episodes on demand. Just go to WPR.org/newsmakers. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. We're back in just a minute. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studio on the campus of UW La Crosse. Content warning, this conversation will include discussion of domestic violence and sexual assault. In roughly the time it takes me to read this introduction, there's another person who will face sexual assault in the U.S., and about 20 people will encounter some form of domestic violence in that amount of time as well. Today on Newsmakers, we'll talk to a couple of people involved in an event called Take Back the Night. It's an event geared at making safer communities by raising awareness around the issues of domestic violence and sexual assault. Joining us today in particular, Tom Birkendall, who's the executive director of Level Up, It's a partnership to end domestic and sexual violence in La Crosse. Tom, thank you very much for being with us on Newsmakers today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And also joining us is Kyle Richard. Kyle, we'll hear more about his athletic career later and how that coincides with all this. But he has become a violence prevention advocate and will be joining Tom and others at Take Back the Night, which is coming up. And we'll share all those details with you on the show today as well. Kyle, thank you for being on Newsmakers.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So I first want to learn about Level Up. Tom, tell me about the organization and how it is that you're working in our community to end domestic and sexual violence.
Well, thank you. Level Up, as you mentioned, is a partnership to end domestic and sexual violence. And we have a why meaning of why purpose of trying to engage men of all ages in the process, because we recognize that approximately 90% of perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual assault are men. But we also know that approximately 90% of men are not perpetrators. So we're working with that 90%, the ones that we refer to as well-meaning men, people like Kyle, who are willing to step up, you know, when they are confronted with a situation that they know isn't right. So that's kind of our purpose. We've been in La Crosse since 2018. We started in 2018. I actually lived in La Crosse for 31 years, and then I moved to Appleton for 16 years, and then I moved back. And when I was in Appleton, I had a leadership position, volunteer, with an organization called the Voices of Men, Fox Valley Voices of Men. So when I moved back to La Crosse after I retired, I started the Cooley Region Voices of Men. And we had a speaker that came in at that time, and we had another speaker in 2018. In both cases, they presented in front of over 2,000 people, primarily young people. And then, of course, COVID hit, and we had to kind of push that aside because you know, we're all about getting in front of people, and we couldn't do that during COVID. So we continue to meet, and we're really happy to be coming back in 22 to feature Kyle with the Take Back the Night event, and we have another speaker coming in toward the end of the year. So very excited to come back. We've been supported just wonderfully by the community, and you know, we're excited to be getting our thing out there again.
You talked about reaching out to those 90% of men who are not going to become perpetrators. As you mentioned, 90% of these assaults are perpetrated by men. So reaching out to that audience, though, how can that audience, like, is the hope that that audience will just be more aware of what's going on in the community and be there as an intervention, or is there some kind of way that 90% can somehow affect the other 10%?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, for selfish reasons, I'm going to say that one thing men can do is come to the event on Tuesday night. It's a week from tonight, the Take Back the Night event. Kyle is a bystander. He's an impactful bystander, and he'll get into his story, I'm sure, a little bit later. But what we're trying to do is teach people how to be effective bystanders. So when they find themselves in the middle of a situation where something is happening that they know isn't right, they'll know what to do. And so it can be a big thing like what Kyle did, or it can be something small, you know, like just for example, a bunch of guys are riding down the street in a car and they see a woman on the side of the road and some guy yells out, you know, something inappropriate to that woman. Everybody laughs. Well, one thing you can do as an effective bystander is not laugh and say, hey, what are you doing? You know what that woman is thinking right now, how scared she is that we're going to stop and do something to her? I mean, just something little like that. So I think it's really important, you know, to get education like everything else. And I think people need to be educated about how to be an impactful bystander.
Kyle Richard is with us. Kyle, a couple of mentions about your story, and I think we've held people off as long as we can. Let's first tell me a little bit about yourself. You were an athlete at a very high level, and then your life took a sudden turn. Tell me about it.
Absolutely. So I spent my time in college playing college football at SUNY Cortland. It's in central New York. I was actually a freshman, my first time I ever heard about Take Back the Night. And coming into college, I didn't know much about sexual violence. Honestly, what I knew was only about false reports. And that's all I really cared about. And most of my community that I grew up in cared about. When I first went to a Take Back the Night, I was blown away. It was a somber feeling. I remember going in, not knowing what to expect, having this energy of being around my teammates that went to the Take Back the Night on my college campus. And once we heard from survivors, you could hear a pin drop. It was somber. There were tears in eyes. And it definitely changed my mind on sexual violence. But I didn't become a sexual violence prevention advocate until 2 years later, 3 years later, really my senior year. The story, the reason why I care deeply and why people look to me to speak at their universities is because going into my junior season, I became a captain, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, I can't wait for the next season. I had 2 weeks before a football camp came up, and I was at a party with my friends. I lived about 5 hours from my school. I lived in Long Island growing up. So I'm at a party with my friends and everything was cool. When the party was over around 2 a.m., no cops shut it down. We were shutting it down ourselves. And one of my friends came and poked her head into the kitchen, and she said, you know, somebody's in the bathroom. And she kind of looked really concerned. So my friend Suli, my friend Jewel, and I, we kind of were like, I don't know what's going on, but let's check it out. We went to the bathroom, and we start really trying to get the door open because we knew something was going on in there. We didn't know exactly what it was. But when the door was finally opened, one of the people in the room was a young woman who throughout the party was stumbling over herself, slurring her words. I even helped her out one time because she fell down the stairs and kind of cut her finger. So I helped her clean her finger off and told her to sit down at one point. And when we opened that door, she was in there. She was clearly not able to consent to anything. She was very under the influence again. And this one person that was in there with her had a smirk on his face, and he was clearly trying to take advantage of her. So me and my friends, we took action. I asked her what was going on. And I was just so angry. I was just so pissed off. We stopped before it happened, but we were so mad, and I was mad. I was like tunnel vision. So I looked throughout the house to see where he is again. Can't find him. I just wanted to see if he was still around. And I saw him in the front yard, and he was just laughing. Well, he was smirking. He acted like he wasn't just trying to take advantage of somebody. So I approached him. I basically was just confronting him about what he did. And he ended up pulling out a gun and started letting shots off on me. The first bullet went through my right leg. The second bullet went through my left leg. He shot again, missed. I was able to run back to the house. I was greeted by my friends. And 30 seconds later, he was letting more shots off. My friends were getting late night food. He started shooting at their car, and one of my friends got hurt. Fortunately, he survived. He had a couple of long-lasting injuries. But that moment, me and my friend, it was just like we didn't know who was going to make it. We were just in shock. I was telling my friend I loved him. Something a lot of men I never did in my life with other my guy friends, right? But luckily we both survived. I had a season to play, and I was able to get back on the field somehow, some way within a month time. And I played for Mike. I played for, my team. And eventually my story broke out because my coach recommended me to a domestic violence organization in central New York, known as the Christens Fund. And when the Christens Fund reached out to give me this award, a reporter from SUNY Cortland asked me about my story. Why am I getting this award? What's going on? So I told my story almost a year later. And once it was published, it just broke like wildfire. I started receiving messages from hundreds of survivors across the world. I started receiving messages from athletes telling me that their family members were in situations like this. And just every type of message thinkable. And one of the messages that one of the types of messages that I can't stand are the ones where there were bystanders present. Yeah, it's horrible. Things happen when there's nobody around. Those are scary situations, but no situation should be scary, especially when you have friends around.
When you're back in that moment, you've been through the situation as you described. The young woman at the party was at that point no longer in danger, but you're going again to try to confront the individual who had been involved in that situation. You see this gun, you see him start shooting, you feel what's happening to you. What's going through your mind at that moment? Are you at that point regretting getting involved, or what, second guessing your decisions, or what's going through your mind then?
I just remember thinking, I'm good. Like, I'm going to survive. It was really a survival mindset for me. Later on though, when I was in the hospital, it became, is Mike going to be okay? My friend that was, unfortunately randomly shot that night, 30 seconds later, then it became, am I going to be able to play football again? Like, what's going to happen to me? What's the rundown? Thinking back on your question and why I even approached him and why I was confronting him, I was angry. Like, I was just pissed off. There's no lighter words to use. I was seeing red. I was pissed. I didn't like what he was trying to do to her. These two people were random to me, but nobody should be trying to take advantage of somebody like that. That's why I was so mad. And people ask me sometimes, do you regret confronting him? Do you regret like going back to him? No, first off, he was still at the party. He was in the front yard. He didn't leave. Who am I supposed to trust, this person at the party still after that? And secondly, every time I think about the moment, I'm just like, I feel like most people in these rooms, when I speak in Wisconsin and lacrosse, I feel like most people in that room would have did the same exact thing. And it's almost impossible for me to say, do I wish what happened? No. But I had to do something. I had to say something. My friends had to say something. And it was tragic, but it doesn't always end up that way, first off. And I wouldn't be able to do anything else. There's no way.
Kyle was talking, Tom, about hearing some of these stories from people in his work where there are bystanders who don't intervene. One can understand any number of fears or emotions that might come up if you're in a situation like that. What is something that you could tell people who might encounter a situation that they think could be dangerous, or they're wondering what level of intervention might be helpful and yet safe at the same time? You don't want to make a bad situation worse. How do you know when it's something that you really should intervene in, Tom?
You know, and to Kyle's point, I don't think you really know, you know, at the time. I think you're reacting to what's happening around you. And, you know, I think that's one reason that it's important to get some training on bystander intervention. And it's something that Kyle is going to be talking about a week from tonight. You know, I think that, you know, not like I mentioned, not everyone is going to do something as extreme as Kyle did. But there are other ways that you can become involved too. And certainly fear has something to do with it. Knowing your surroundings has something to do with your decision-making. You know, it's something like, you know, it tends to be instinctive, but I think it would be very beneficial for people, if they find themselves in that situation in the future, to have had some kind of training in terms of what is important and how do we effectively impact this situation.
Kyle, you talked about having been to a Take Back the Night event years prior to the event that you described, with the shooting and intervening in what could have been a sexual assault. Tell me about your experience at that Take Back the Night event and how that informed, or whether it did, how you reacted in that moment on that night at the party.
What it really did was teach me how to care. Simple as that, simply put. I mean, going into college, you just hear about, people are lying about being this, sexually assaulted. And that was basically my education in high school. Not through my school, but that's just what I learned on the streets and around my friends. And we just were taught what we knew. And then when I went to Take Back the Night, that feeling of first hearing from survivors that were classmates or students on campus, and hear, you know, hearing their voices, hearing, you know, their voice crack, seeing their tears. It was definitely one of the hardest conversations I've ever seen at, to that point in my life. And then to be able to be empowered and march with the student body, with my teammates, in support of these survivors, it gave me that juice to say, oh shoot, there's more to sexual violence. There's more to this. And I believe this was either right before the Me Too got bigger. But it was, I just remember that's all I the first time I really heard from actual survivors of sexual violence, and it changed my perspective forever. And now that you say it, I went the next year, we went annually. I went my sophomore year. Maybe these hours or 2 hours of speaking and listening to stories and marching, maybe that's what gave me the anger to be pissed off about somebody sexually assaulting somebody else or trying to take advantage, in my case, trying to take advantage of somebody that was under the influence. So yeah, it just taught me to care. Take Back the Night taught me to that men, women, anybody can be a part of speaking out against sexual violence.
The language has changed around or has grown around this subject matter. I remember, you know, you of course, everyone has heard excuses about false reporting and those kinds of things. Even people who are trying to be helpful often resort to language. And a lot of the presentations I went to as a youth were about things like what a young lady could do to avoid being a victim of sexual assault, what she should wear, right, who she should hang out with, those kinds of things. Tom, how important is this shift in language toward, you know, away from, you know, if this situation is happening to you, what have you done wrong, more toward this idea of bystander intervention and about all of us looking out for each other to make sure that things like this don't happen?
Well, what you're referring to is what we call victim blaming. You know, oh, she had too much to drink, she had it coming or whatever. And I certainly hope that that's changing. You know, I know Kyle had mentioned that, you know, things seem to be the same in some regards as they have in the past. But as we learn more and as men, you know, as we learn more about the things that women go through, whether they've been assaulted or not, just the fact that they're women, the things that they have to that they are confronted with every day, hopefully that changes the hearts of the people that are hearing those stories. And I know, you know, Kyle talks about his Take Back the Night experience. I had my own experience in Appleton when I was there, and I went to my first Voices of Men event. When you hear these stories, it changes a person. And I think part of that change is changing attitudes. And part of that is to recognize victim blaming when you see it or you hear it. And it's never the victim's fault. It's never the victim's fault. And we need to stress that and believe that.
So tell me about Take Back the Night. Time to get some details about this year's event. It's going to be on the campus of the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. I know other campuses are involved in supporting the event as well. Tell me all about it, Tom.
It's going to be held in Mitchell Hall. It's going to begin at 7 o'clock, and Kyle is going to present first. And when Kyle is done, there's going to be a short march around the campus, and then there'll be, you know, speakers and kind of a rally after that. I think you'll probably hear from some victims, and I think they'll have an open mic, you know, so whoever wants to talk can talk. I think both of those parts of the event, the Take Back the Night event, are very important and are going to be very emotional and very powerful. And you know, we're encouraging people from the community to come. We're encouraging students of all ages. Well, I shouldn't say all ages, but of high school and you know, college age, certainly, to come. Free parking right in front of Mitchell Hall that night, and parking lot C2. Of course, the event itself is free and open to the public. So we really want to encourage people to come. I promise you that if you take the time to come, You're going to be happy that you did. It will change your life.
And that's this coming Tuesday, the 29th, right?
Correct.
Tuesday, the 29th, 7 o'clock. Tom Birkedahl is the executive director of Level Up, which is a partnership to end domestic and sexual violence. Tom, thank you much for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you for having me.
Kyle Richard is a college football player turned sexual violence prevention advocate. Kyle, thank you very much for sharing your story. I'm glad you were here to tell it, and look forward to seeing you in La Crosse.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. Can't wait.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's how you can listen to our program every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network, 90.3, and Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music, 88.9. Of course, we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. For Dawn Jewell, our producer, I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.